Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 14 of Citizens Climate Radio, the project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, July 24th, 2017. In today's show, we hear several answers to last month's puzzler question. What is a food you love that is threatened by climate change? In the Art House, we feature a silly song about a serious subject, science. And in our main section, today, we talk about the end of the world. Or maybe we shouldn't. Today we talk about fear and the role it can, should, or should never play when talking about climate change. Doomsday. On July 9th, 2017, at 9 p.m., the story dropped. David Wallace Wells, writing for New York Magazine, delivered a blow to New York City and beyond. He published an article entitled The Uninhabitable World. In it, he asks, when will climate change make the Earth too hot for humans? Wallace Wells outlined what might happen if we do nothing about climate change. He paints a grim picture. Here are some of the section titles in Wallace Wells' article. They sound a lot like the teasers you hear when they're trying to get people to tune into the evening news. Heat death, the Bahraining of New York. Climate plagues, what happens when bubonic ice melts? Unbreathable air, a ruling death smog that suffocates millions. And perpetual war, the violence baked into the heat. This and more tonight on News Warnings. That, plus he warns of economic collapse and poisoned oceans. Dire stuff. Of course, this is not the first time New York City faced a major threat.
The city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Wallace Wells never claims that all these things will come to pass exactly how he describes them. At the beginning of his article, he writes, quote, "What follows is not a series of predictions of what will happen. That will be determined in large part by the much less certain science of human response. Instead, it is a portrait of our best understanding of where the planet is heading absent aggressive action. It is unlikely that all of these warning scenarios will be fully realized, largely because the devastation along the way will shake our complacency." End quote. As soon as his piece appeared, the climate communication world reacted strongly. Some say Wallace Wells went too far, others that he didn't go far enough. Two camps quickly formed, those who defended the piece and others who denounced it. While some detractors debated the science, the biggest problem they had were the methods used in it. This article stirred up fear. An alternate title for the piece could easily be Climate Change. Be afraid. Be very afraid. For the past 5 years or more, climate communication experts stressed fear should not be used when talking to the public about climate change. It can have a negative effect. In her reaction to the scary article, Rachel Becker reviews some of the social science on scare tactics. Becker explains, quote, "The balance between sharing alarming information and being alarmist is tricky," end quote. While admitting communication researchers have mixed views about fear and messaging, Becker concludes we should avoid fear. Quote, scare tactics can backfire when people put up their psychological defenses against the threatening information rather than defending against the threat itself. These can include paying less attention to a frightening message or straight-up denial about the extent of the danger. End quote. The thinking goes that when people face an immediate threat, fire in a movie theater or, say, a tornado warning, fear provokes the fight-or-flight instinct, an immediate strong reaction. But with a big threat that unfolds over time with no immediate felt danger, it is harder for humans to process. Our imaginations are not big enough to take it all in. For some further insight, I turn to the Icelandic scientist Halldór Björnsson. He is the head of the Atmospheric Research Group at Veðurstofa Íslands, also known as the Icelandic Met Office. He lives and works in Reykjavik. I first interviewed him 2 years ago. At that time, I found him surprisingly optimistic about humans' ability to respond to climate change.
Most climate scientists I know are not pessimists, and none of them are defeaters. Climate change is probably fighting it and winning it. It's probably an effort on the magnitude of fighting a major war, but it's, you know, it doesn't have to kill anyone, which is a good thing, and it probably wouldn't be as intense at any one moment. It would just take a longer time. This is a war we can win. You know, when you talk about transforming the energy system, you have so many people saying, well, you know, it's not economical, it's not going to work, blah, blah, blah. And then you actually go, okay, well, this is going to raise the price of electricity by 10% or something. And you go, yeah, well, that's probably not a huge cost given, you know, what's going to happen if you don't do this. You know, I will bet you that if once you've done the transition, the same people would look back and say, well, there was no other way of doing it like we did, you know.
Right in the middle of the New York Magazine article debate, I followed up with Halldór Björnsson on Facebook. I asked him about fear and climate communication. He wrote back, quote, fear is a good motivator when there is an immediate danger. But for long-term risk, such as the risk of future forest fire engulfing your home, or an avalanche hitting your house, or sea level rise due to climate change filling up your basement, where fight or flight response is of little use, then fear is not a good motivator. End quote. Still, lots of people are defending the New York Magazine article and its use of fear. David Roberts wrote a piece for Vox entitled, "Did that New York Climate Magazine freak you out? Good." Roberts raises questions about the commonly held belief that the climate communicator should not use fear tactics. He writes, quote, first, social scientists are forever testing how individuals respond to various messages in lab conditions, in the short term. But the dynamics that matter most on climate are social and long term. It may be that there are social dynamics that require some fear and paralysis before a collective breakthrough. At the very least, it seems excessive to draw a pat fear never works conclusion from these sorts of data. End quote. Last month, I attended a climate communication talk at the Nonfiction Now conference in Iceland. A panel of scholars came together to talk about apocalypse. They considered hope, hype, and apocalyptic anxiety. How can we mobilize nonfiction for climate change? The panel was facilitated by Christian Birkdal, who has a PhD in rhetoric. He continues his studies at the Center for Development and the Environment at the University of Oslo. In his introduction, Dr. Birkdal gets right to the heart of our discussion about fear and climate change.
Our concern in this session will be how we are, how we can, and how we should mobilize nonfiction writing for climate change. And our starting point, as our title reveals, is that a great deal of current climate change discourse is apocalyptic in nature. And I think we can reveal as much. There is this sense among the panelists that something is a bit wrong with that mode. Now, this motive of apocalypse is, as we know, at least as old as the Bible. Well, it's older than the Bible, but many of us know it from there. And you find this everywhere, but one of the most memorable instances of this kind of apocalyptic climate rhetoric that I ever came across was at a climate conference co-organized by the Church of Norway, where one of our bishops got on the stage and said that, well, climate change is, as they say, one of the greatest threats we face today. But all our talk about it isn't having the desired effect. It isn't having any effect at all. Obviously, the bishop's proposal was that we go to the Bible to see what resources are there with which to build a contemporary narrative about climate change, basically about ourselves at this point in time. More concretely, he said we should go to the book of Revelation, so to the Apocalypse of John, as it's also called, which, as some might remember, is one hellish story, if you could use a word like that, where a whole catalogue of devilry descends on humanity. There's earthquakes, mountains and continents that move out of place, stars that fall to the ground, seven-headed dragons that come on the scene to eat children, bottomless pits that open up, and so on.
Sounds familiar, but does it work? And if so, when is it most effective to insert fear into our conversations about climate? Dr. Bjørkdal travels back in time to consult a master of rhetoric.
And if we go to Aristotle, who is the father of rhetoric as a systematic form of study, he had, in fact, quite a lot to say, not so much about apocalypse, but about fear as a rhetorical device. And he said, fear can be perfectly legitimate and also sensible rhetorical device given that certain requirements are fulfilled. So only under certain conditions ought you use fear. And those requirements were, for fear to be appropriate, the threat would have to be real, so not virtual or imagined. The threat would have to be severe, so not negligible, and it would have to involve a loss of some kind, a great loss, he says. It would have to be imminent, so near to us in time and place. And it would also have to affect us and not just some set of others.
Okay, it is only the very beginning of this panel and I am already on the edge of my seat. But it's so weird hearing all of this. There I was in Northern Europe with virtually 24 hours of gorgeous sunlight. It is beautiful outside, sunny with crisp, fresh air and spring flowers exploding all over the place. It was nearly impossible to imagine the dire risks of climate change. So maybe a little fear is necessary to stir up the conversation? Does Aristotle's criteria for talking about fear apply?
One might think that climate change does fulfill all these requirements, but I think upon closer scrutiny, I think we can see that it actually does not. Climate change, I think most can agree, is real, but is the threat that climate change represents that real? I'm not so sure. So climate scientists, for instance, have grown quite confident when it comes to diagnosing the situation. So they're very certain that climate change is real, but they're not as successful or not even as confident when it comes to describing the consequences. They try to do that, but they're quite honest about saying that we don't actually know precisely what will happen because this is too complex to prophesy. And if it isn't, the threat isn't real in that way, how severe is it really? Probably is very severe, but is it experienced as severe in our everyday lives? Again, I doubt that. At least in our part of the world, very few actually live the consequences of climate change. And if they do, they're not necessarily aware of that fact. The threat also does not seem very imminent. There is talk now about tipping points, that we're kind of closing in on the tipping point, but again, nobody really experiences that tipping point, at least not yet. And we don't really see the contours of it because we don't know what will tip and how, you know? And the threat also appears to be more severe for others than for us. The threat appears far worse for the global south than the north. The poor seem, again, to be far worse off than the rich. So Aristotle, I think, would say that given these conditions, apocalypse or fear should just be dropped. Find another way of conveying this message.
Apocalypse. Such a strong word. when I hear it, it hits my ears in a funny way. In addition to my work as a climate advocate, I am also a Bible scholar. The word apocalypse comes from a Koine Greek word, apokalypsis. In its original form, it means a revealing or an unveiling. It is a revelation, as if a curtain is suddenly pulled back. One sees what has been hidden from sight. That unveiling jars us awake. In fact, this describes very well what many climate advocates have experienced. They heard a talk, saw a movie, read a book, and suddenly grasped how severe the problem of climate change is. It jolted them into action. And for many of us, fear was part of that revelation. The fear of what could happen if we do nothing. So we must do something. Back to Halldór Björnsson. On our Facebook thread, I asked him about another strong emotion, anger. Does it help to stir up anger for our audience? What if we were to twin outrage with fear? He wrote, quote, "I think anger is important, but also sheer determination," end quote. He then goes on to explain something that puzzled me on my recent trip to Iceland. After the conference in Reykjavik, my husband Glenn and I traveled to the Westfjords to stay in the little fishing village of Flateyri. There, stunning fjords tower over the sea inlet, and on a tiny peninsula is this town with less than 200 inhabitants. Driving into Flateyri, I marveled at the mountains and the sea, and then I noticed something man-made. At the base of the mountain, directly overshadowing the village, are earthenworks. They constructed a giant triangle-shaped wall as big as a football stadium. The base of the triangle hovers over the entire village. The other two sides extend beyond the village by hundreds of meters. It looks like a massive arrowhead pointing up from the village at the mountain. This is an anti-avalanche barrier. Halldór explained, quote, "In 1995, 30 people died in two avalanches in northwest Iceland. Two small towns were decimated. The people there had known about the risk for a long time, but ignored it. Official response was never sufficient to tackle it. However, once this had happened and the initial trauma had subsided, it came down to this never again mindset," end quote. On October 26, 1995, at 4:06 a.m., the avalanche crashed into the little town of Flateyri. It destroyed 29 homes. 20 people died. Today, when you visit this beautiful fishing village, you will see reminders of the tragedy, the graves, the historical marker, and the stories residents share. But the biggest memorial is the massive anti-avalanche barrier. But not only do they build this one barrier and develop plans to protect this village, they organized a nationwide effort to keep a tragedy like this from ever happening again. This effort includes regular monitoring, a sophisticated evacuation plan, and state-of-the-art hazard mapping that is constantly updated. Halldór explains, quote, "After that, I'm not sure anger or fear are the right descriptors of the mood that subsequently took hold. Rather, it was sheer determination that appropriate measures would be taken, villages moved, deflectors built, etc. It was this, we can fix this and we will, attitude. It is, of course, sad that people had to die before this happened. I'm always waiting for the great American ethos of this is wrong, let's fix it, to take over the debate in the U.S. End quote. The United States can be slow to act. Witness World War II. Most historians mark the beginning of the war with the Nazi invasion of Poland in September 1939. While the U.S. Congress allowed the sale of arms to France and Britain, the U.S. stayed out of the fight. The Canadians, Australians, and others sent troops as debate raged among American politicians and the public. Some even outright denied the atrocities the Jews and other marginalized groups suffered by the Nazis in Germany and occupied countries. Then, on December 7, 1941, more than 2 years after the start of the war, the Japanese government attacked Hawaii at Pearl Harbor. Immediately, there was political will to join the war effort. With breathtaking speed, the U.S. government and public galvanized resources and mobilized a robust response. So when it comes to climate change, do Americans need a Pearl Harbor moment to get fully engaged? Some point to Hurricane Katrina, Superstorm Sandy, the drought in California, or the almost constant wildfires in the West and Northwest. If the climate were a foreign power or a terror organization, it has already attacked the USA multiple times in multiple places. Individuals and regions have responded to these events. Communities have experienced apocalypse, that revelation that we are in grave danger and we must act. And they are acting. But nationally, many people living in the USA still hear dismissive talk, saw a retreat from climate action, and live in a suspended state of inaction. What will it take? Perhaps a series of extreme heat events so severe they sear into people's minds the severity of the times we face. Hopefully not. Climate communications expert Edward Maybach tells us, quote, "The biggest problem is the climate silence in America," end quote. If Maybach and other communicators are right about this, one of the most important roles we have to play is to break that silence. Some might say by any means necessary. That is the vital work you do every time you open your mouth about climate change. That's what you do when you engage with your friends through social media or reach out to public officials. We may disagree about tactics. We need to listen to each other and definitely to the communication experts. But this is uncharted territory in lots of ways. With a problem this big, one size does not fit all. Your creativity and ability to build relationships are vital. And sometimes, maybe, you just have to scare the snot out of people. I would love to hear your thoughts about climate communication. I'd like to hear your own successes and questions. You can email your comments to me at the following address, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. We also have a listener call line that I will give out at the end of the show. I am curious and interested in what you have to say. Now it is time for the Art House. Today I will play you a song by Jason Zekowitz, a Master of Sustainability at Arizona State University. Jason has been creating original, humorous, and insightful songs about climate change and related issues. Here is his song, Scientist. It is sung to the tune of the Beauty and Beast classic, Be Our Guest.
To a fellow global citizen, if you're a fan of discovery or innovation, then let's enlighten our sight. And now, you are invited to think critically. Take notes liberally as the laboratory proudly presents
our research.
Scientists, put our research to the test. Get your lab coat on your back, my friend, and draw to a thesis. Biology, astronomy, all share objectivity. Make observations, be a witness. Don't believe me? Think of questions. What's a star? What's an atom? Does my energy even matter? You can find out for yourself, or you can guess. Go on and get your data, share it for review from scientists, scientists, scientists.
gravity, relativity, organism taxonomy. We'll prepare and serve with proof, postulates, laws, and corollaries. You have thoughts and questions. Let us start with observations. No one's fighting or defensive, while egos are academic. Integrity is the key to objectivity. Accurate knowledge is the common interest. Go on, create some questions to clear up suspicions of scientists. If you're perplexed, then find questions to solve it. Of science, for science, with science. Life is so unnerving if research is not referenced, especially when there is scientific consensus. Those nonpartisan days, we formed the EPA. Who would have thought we would ask back for Nixon? 121 years, we had the report warning us of global warming. And that is why we ask for a price on carbon. For most days, we just lay around the Capitol. Underfunded, undefended. You lobby, we have an agenda. Scientist, scientist, Pope Francis says you are blessed, gladly showing his support for the climate change report. Industry wants carbon feed to be green and compete. We have a climate solutions caucus of 38 members of Congress. I will build political will just by saying I can't chill. Who is responsible for our pollution? So let us give fossil fuels accurate value from scientists, economists, environmentalists, political scientists, scientists, naturally inquisitive. 100 years saying greenhouse gas will be our death, and we're obsessed with the truth, with the proof, and making government resolute. While the parties are arguing, the sea level keeps on growing. Sure, by sure. Before we reach 2 degrees, let us start to agree to science. Scientists, scientists, please respect science.
To hear more of Jason Zakowitz's music, check out his YouTube channel. You can find him on YouTube when you search for Science Sigh. Sigh as in the exhalation of breath. S-I-G-H. That's Science Sigh. Or you can check him out on Twitter at Science Sigh. Jason told me that he is creating the Earth Art Contest. It is a prize contest for students to create their own art that can be used for outreach, education, and engagement. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Before we end this episode, I have answers to last month's puzzler. I asked, what is a food that you love that is threatened by climate change? At the recent Citizens Climate International Conference, I asked this question and received some of the following answers.
Nadine Sapperman. I'm from Central New Jersey. There are many foods that are affected by climate change. I've been talking to farmers in my district who express concern about their crops, apples and pears and peaches and all of those, tree fruits. They're having a difficulty because of the extreme weather, the cold, the extreme rain, and it's affecting farmers in my area.
Tommy Evans, a food that I love that's affected by climate change? Well, that would be chocolate, of course. Hershey is really concerned about the ability to grow chocolate in places where it won't grow anymore. So, food, chocolate, climate change.
This is Jim Tolbert, and a food that's threatened by climate change that I love are hamburgers. Eating a hamburger is like driving a race car with your pedal all the way down. There is so much methane emission there. If you care about climate change, it's something you got to give up, and I hate that.
Thank you to everyone who answered the puzzler question. Okay, you ready for the next question? Using metaphor to talk about climate change is very important. We can relate the effects of climate change and our responses to it to our own lives in many ways, including our childhood experiences. Fill in the blank. When I think about climate change, it reminds me of when... blank. When I think about climate change, it reminds me of when... think back to your childhood. The memory may have absolutely nothing to do with climate change. It might be about a loss you experienced, a sudden change in your life, or a revelation about your role in the world. When I think about climate change, it reminds me of when... fill in the blank and explain. Send me your answers, leave your name, contact information, and where you're from. Get back to me by August 15th, 2017. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text me or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number: 570-483-8194, +1 if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 570-483-8194. Thank you for listening to Citizens Climate Radio. This show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Keck, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All of the music we use on the show is licensed, unless otherwise specified. In today's show, you heard a short clip from the original Ghostbusters movie and a little of that movie's theme song. Special music for the Art House segment includes one suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. Be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Please do. Just look for Citizens Climate Lobby on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher Radio. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio. CitizensCRadio. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to today's program. I provide a dig deeper section so you can learn more about the topics we discuss. An easy way to share the show with your friends or to just find it easily is to get a link to it over at ccl.podbean.com. On the right, you will see Citizens Climate Radio listed under categories. That's ccl.podbean.com. Bean, as in mung bean. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.